Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to Green Templeton College and also to the Berkeley Lecture for 2014. This is a very important event in the annual cycle of Green Templeton College's academic life, as it was for Templeton College before it and the Oxford Centre for Management Studies before that. It's made possible by the generosity of the Berkeley family in memory of Clifford and Evelyn Berkeley. Those of you familiar with the history will know that Clifford Berkeley was one of the key figures in the founding of the OCMS in 1965. And on the 5th of June 2015, we shall celebrate the 50th anniversary of this hugely important step in our institutional history with a special conference, at which, incidentally, the next Berkeley lecture will be given and delivered on that occasion by His Eminence Cardinal Vincent Nichols, Archbishop of Westminster. Clifford's legacy has been continued by his son Stephen, one of our governing body Berkeley Fellows, and his wife Jane. In addition to this annual lecture, the family also support a Berkeley Scholar in the college each year. And in 2012, Stephen, representing the family, and in recognition of their generous support over many years to the college and its predecessors, was elected to the Vice-Chancellor's Circle. Previous Berkeley lectures have included Eddie George, David Rowland, Charles Handy, Tom Burke, Stuart Rose, Richard Lambert, Bill Castell, Richard Frank, Peter Tufano, and most recently, Dame Helen Alexander. This evening's lecture will open up one of the most important and one of the most fascinating aspects of the contemporary business scene, the challenge of innovation in the digital world. And we're delighted to welcome Professor David Gann, CBE, to deliver the 2014 lecture. David is Imperial College's Vice President, leading development and innovation. He's responsible for shaping the vision, the strategy, and the innovation agenda for Imperial College, and notably, the development of its new 25-acre West London campus, Imperial West. He's had a remarkably rich and productive career in academia, in business, and in public administration. He's been one of the UK's seriously deep thinkers about innovation, as reflected in a stream of influential publications, of which my favourite continues to be Think, Play, Do. He knows how to run a major business, as he has done in his career as a civil engineer. Also, as the London academic and business community knows, he gets things done. Imperial West is set to be one of the most striking developments of UK higher education in the community so far in this century. And I'm delighted to be able to acknowledge a personal and professional friendship that goes back at least a quarter of a century. I can report that he's a thoroughly inspirational, effective, and enjoyable person to work with. We're looking forward tonight to hearing what he has to say under his title, New Patterns of Innovation in the Digital World. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor David Gann.
Thank you, David, and good evening. Thank you, Stephen, for sponsoring this lecture. It's a pleasure to be here, and listening to that list of the roster of speakers that have gone before me, it's quite an honour to try and live up to giving you this lecture. You'll notice I'm not using PowerPoints, and that's partly because I've seen so many PowerPoints recently in lectures. I didn't want to spew them out on you. And it's partly because I think sometimes the images that come into your own mind's eye might be better than the ones I can create for you. And I want to explore some ideas here that we don't have answers to, and that will just conjure images and hear your views as we go forward. What I want to talk about is the way in which the world is changing. I'll try and define innovation and give you some bedrock for the thinking, first of all, and then get into some questions about what's happening, particularly with the advent of the internet and what some people call big data, and how that's affecting and shaping the way in which knowledge is developed and the way in which knowledge is applied. And I've already given you a definition of innovation, haven't I? The creation of knowledge and its application. So The other thing about this is that we're starting to understand new patterns of entrepreneurship, new types of collaboration across boundaries between institutions and organisations, between businesses, and new types of jobs. So there are questions already I'm trying to seed here, and then we can perhaps discuss how you see some of these attributes. And of course, innovation, the successful application of new ideas or new combinations of ideas, is something that's driven our economy and society for many years now. Central to the thinking of people like Karl Marx, Adam Smith, more recently Joseph Schumpeter, who is the bedrock in trying to understand the economics of innovation, and people like William Baumol. Resulting, I think, in higher standards of living, but also beset with risk. And so there's a duality here in our minds about what innovation means and does. It can result in catastrophic failure. And I think the untested financial innovations that were launched on us all over the last decade, and the global crisis and recession that they caused, are a good example. The longer range examples are some of the damage that we're beginning to understand to our natural environment because of innovations that have been created in industry. Sometimes innovation appears to offer benefits only later to be found wanting. Now, I thought just to calibrate that, think of Thomas Midgley. Does that name ring a bell for anyone? Thomas Midgley. 1920s, first of all working at General Motors, he discovered tetraethyl lead and introduced it into petrol to reduce the NOx in internal combustion engines. We all know, or I hope you know, the consequences of lead in petrol and what it did to the health, particularly of our children, by breathing the fumes in. If that wasn't enough to have created, he created Freon, a non-toxic CFC gas for refrigerants, replacing sulfur dioxide, which was visibly injuring and killing people. But of course, CFCs have done latterly enormous damage to the environment. And his last great invention, he suffered from polio and was severely disabled. He invented a system of ropes and pulleys for others to get him out of bed. Sadly, he died of strangulation at the age of 55 after becoming trapped in the ropes. So I've started off with a salutary story of innovation here. let me move swiftly into a happier place, I think. We know a lot now about innovation processes, and let me just give you a very quick canter through a traditional view of this. Mark Dodgson, my co-author, and I wrote a little Oxford University Press book not so long ago, Innovation, A Very Short Introduction. It's one of those little pocket books. And it began with a story of an exemplary innovator and someone that we think is still perhaps the world's greatest, if there ever was a league table of innovators. Someone whose ideas illustrate many of the facets of the restless entrepreneur and the pursuit of success that innovators have to pursue. And he established an enduring high-profile company that had substantial innovations in its products and the way they were produced, and the way that they were sold to customers, made a big contribution to national infrastructure, helped create a dynamic regional industry, and pioneered new export markets. And I'm wondering if you can guess who I'm thinking of. No? Closer. Let me carry on for a little bit longer. He became a fellow of the Royal Society because he made a fantastic scientific invention that changed the way in which we measure things. And I think perhaps the best attribute was the way in which he tried to improve the quality of life of the people that worked in and around him in the society within which he lived. Josiah Wedgwood. And actually, I partly chose Josiah Wedgwood because we're sitting very close to the Radcliffe Observatory, and of course that was built at the same time that Wedgwood was alive. And by the way, Wedgwood was a character. He suffered from smallpox as a child, and by the time he was in his mid-30s, he was limping around, and he was so fed up with his immobility that he went and had his leg amputated without anaesthetic and without antiseptic. And he was back to work within a month of that operation. Again, a little vignette that shows you the drive, perhaps, of some entrepreneurs to get things done. Many things we could say about Wedgwood. I'll leave you to read the story, actually, in detail. But I'll just pick out a few areas of innovation, product innovation. He searched for new materials, new glazes, new designs, new colours. And his favourite motto, everything yields to experiment. So think about that, experimentation. Some of his innovations were incremental, and there's an important term there. Incremental innovation is adding to knowledge that we already have and improving the conditions or the performance. And in fact, he created a high-quality ceramic that later became a dinner service for Queen Charlotte, who was the wife of George III. And he received her approval and named it Queensware, and it became a very commonly sold product. His radical innovation, and he had 5,000 difficult and expensive experiments to make to get there, was the production of jasper. And that was the blue Wedgwood ceramic that we all know and is still in production today, 250 years later. So many other attributes, process innovation, steam power. The Staffordshire potteries were the first to be driven by steam, reducing the cost of transport, mechanising processes that used to be done by hand. And, you know, there was a preoccupation at the time with quality, with production process, with how skills were used. And that pursuit of quality drove him to measure. And in his measurements, he developed the pyrometer. You know what that is? The thermometer. And it was for the thermometer that he was inducted as a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1783. He had lots of organisational innovations. He listened to his contemporary Adam Smith and specialised some of the work, which allowed the designers as craftsmen to do more work on design and push the quality of design out there. He paid higher wages. He was an innovator in the way in which his business was conducted in terms of supply chains. The first global sourcing business was Wedgwood, in terms of where he got his clays from, in America, in China, and in Australia. And he opened showrooms, by the way. He had a direct order business. And it was very fashionable to be seen in London in a Wedgwood showroom. You'd go and meet other fashionable people. I don't know if you ever go into the Apple store in Regent Street. But I reckon that's the modern day equivalent. He had self-service, he had catalogues, he had pattern books, he had free carriage of goods. Jane Austen wrote of the pleasure of safe delivery of a Wedgwood order. So I think, in fact, that Wedgwood would have liked Amazon, because he would have found new channels to market. And marketing was his big thing. When he started, it was rare for any Staffordshire pottery to go even to London, let alone overseas. By the mid-1780s, 80% of the total production that he was making was exported abroad. These are quite incredible achievements at that time. And somehow we can try and calibrate that with the achievements of entrepreneurs of today. And that's a thought. The other last thing about Wedgwood, before we get into the more modern world, was his group of friends, the polymath, the lunamen. Erasmus Darwin, Matthew Boulton, James Watt, Joseph Priestley, they all shared their ideas. They were rule breakers. They were very interested in the Boulton Watt factory, the steam engines and so on, but they were interested in all sorts of other ideas. Jenny Uglow wrote a wonderful book about the lunamen, and she evocatively suggests their sort of meetings. They met, by the way, on the night of a full moon. That's why they were called the lunamen. And she talks about science and art were not separated. You could be an inventor and designer, an experimenter and a poet, a dreamer and an entrepreneur all at once. And I think that's another important feature and lesson we can take. So perhaps the legacy of that, actually, in the Staffordshire potteries that lasted for a very long time, you would call an innovative industrial cluster. And if you think of Michael Porter's recent work, comparatively, you know, what would he have made at that time of what was happening in Staffordshire? And Wedgwood's wealth was used to good effect. He funded his grandson, Charles Darwin, on the great voyages that led to a massive new understanding. One of his sons created the Royal Horticultural Society. And again, there's some sort of reminiscence here with what people like Bill Gates are trying to do with their legacies in today's world. So there, in a nutshell, is a story of innovation. It gives us some calibration points of what people are able to achieve. And I think it set the scene, actually, for a period of 200 years of industrial innovation and development. And, of course, the 19th century, in many regards, British industry really grew very strongly on the back of these almost heroic engineers and entrepreneurs, as did the US industrial development. And the break point in that comes around the time of Thomas Edison, whoever it was called out Thomas Edison, because Edison was the one who put in place, in many ways, the first contract research and development capability. So hitherto, these people marshalled their resources around them and managed them in their own family-based types of businesses. But Edison said, let's bring technology and scientists together for third-party use and contract in and out. And that was a big change, because that gave us the beginnings of the corporate and industrial research and development machine. And the 20th century, of course, was dominated by, in many regards, the great technology company with its tens of thousands of people working in specialist ways, developing new products and processes. And think about the Bell Labs in the 1950s and 60s. You know, an edifice of more than 30,000 people coming together to work in a purposeful way to develop new technologies for the future. And somehow or another, we had that flip. And the economist Schumpeter, really, in his writings, gives us that. The Schumpeter 1 writing, all about the entrepreneur and this entrepreneurial spirit, the 19th century, the 18th century, and then the 20th century with this more formalised, systematic innovation process that I think most of us would have some intuitive feel for, because we all use the products and benefit from that. And if you think about how a car is designed and made, even if you haven't been to a factory or been in a design workshop, you have some sense of prototyping, of specialists coming in at different times, of testing, and then launching a new product. And that's almost ingrained in all of us in some regard. And so from the point of view of studying these things, which is what I spent most of my life doing, as well as helping and advising companies to put these things into practice, since the Second World War, we've had more and more expertise trying to understand how these innovation processes work, what they mean, and how they can be improved. So industrial economics is one strong thread in this area. From a more macro point of view, evolutionary economics. How does technology relate to the way in which economies grow or not? And then work in strategy, in business strategy, in organisational studies, behavioural, how do teams work together, how do we bring different disciplines to bear to answer these problems. And there are a number of notable academics, Chris Freeman, who founded the Science Policy Research Unit in the early days in the 1960s, was a giant in thinking through these matters, as was Roy Rothwell, who influenced me, both of them influenced me a lot. I was at the Science Policy Research Unit, and a couple of colleagues here tonight were there too. People like Herb Simon, the sciences of the artificial, you know, how do we design using modern material? How do we even invent our materials? The rise of chemistry, very, very important in terms of developing modern industry. And so it went on. And I think by the time we got into the 1980s, we understood very well these patterns. And I became a researcher in the early 80s. And one of the first things that I was studying was the implications of what we called information and computer technology on industrial processes. And this was at the time when computer-aided design and manufacture were being introduced. We had things like the Engineering Industry Training Board in this country sponsoring research, NEDO, government policies. And I know, Michael Earle, your work on in the 1980s and 90s on how does IT affect the business and operating processes of organisations. And this, to me, and I'm giving you this little background because this gets us where academe had got to in terms of understanding technology and IT with regard to innovation and processes in businesses. There was a huge program in MIT in the 1990s, Rethinking the Corporation. Very influential, and a lot of it looking at how to re-engineer using data about how businesses worked. And the other point to note at this time, the late 20th century, that great corporate R&D machine that sucked in huge resources and employed the talent out of places like Oxford and Imperial College was beginning to sputter. It was beginning to become so expensive and difficult to maintain and manage, and the results weren't necessarily coming through. And so those are the conditions. And now let's look at what happened in a very short window of history and why I'm going to make a bold statement that I don't mind being shot down on in a moment about what's happening in the digital world. First of all, the conditions within which business and universities and government were thinking about these things was changing. And markets, and first time I've used the word, I think, markets are tremendously important if you're trying to understand innovation, particularly if you're an economist. You know, you want to try and understand technology and their markets and their use. Well, one of the big shifts is very obvious, a move from the production of things to the delivery of services. And, you know, this country now, in terms of its GDP, is producing something like 75-80% of what we produce as services. And we all lament sometimes that we don't manufacture and make things as much as we used to. Another shift was a process of globalization or internationalization of markets. It happened in some ways quite quickly, although I've already shown you that Wedgwood managed to get there back in the 18th century. There was also an understanding of users and customers. People like Eric von Hippel at MIT did some wonderful studies of user-engaged innovation and how technology would come from points of use where problems were really revealed rather than in the lab. Equally, we as educators were educating people who didn't just want to work for the corporate R&D machine. And talent was finding new ways of doing things and wanting to hang out in places with good amenities, like the west coast of the US, you know, in the coffee bars. And now, in that regard, Richard Florida's work, The Rise of the Creative Class, is quite interesting, isn't it? Because it shows that smart people don't necessarily want to work for the big corporates. They'll set their own thing up and play their own game. Then, of course, and this is where the really interesting stuff for me in terms of technology and innovation came, is the advent of the internet. How do ideas flow in the mix that then creates new products and services? And can you search for ideas that you don't have yourself? And that is where I submit is the first game changer in the way in which innovation process takes shape. And David, you mentioned this book that I wrote, Think, Play, Do, with Mark Dodgson and Eamon Sauter. We were working on that for 4 or 5 years from about 2000. We were highly influenced by a number of people in terms of the question of how information technology affects the innovation process itself. There were people like Stephen Tomke at MIT who'd written a book called Experimentation Matters, and I deliberately chose this, harking back to Wedgwood's motto, everything yields to experiment. And if you're going to be an experimenter, how are you going to conduct those experiments and how are you going to transact that knowledge that comes out of them. Michael Schrager, MIT, wrote a book called Serious Play. Serious Play was about how you test out ideas and find the most satisfying, to use Herb Simon's term, solution for what it is that you want to produce. And we found, through case studies in many companies, from mining through to the fashion industry, that businesses that were being more effective in getting new products and services into the market more quickly were using a combination of digital simulation tools, which means that they could change designs very rapidly and assess what might work. They were communicating and searching, often using the internet, so that they weren't just working with the people in the room. They were connecting into ideas wherever useful people were. And they were using new types of visualization that would translate complex ideas for non-cognate groups, which meant that they could work with customers in new ways. And so simulation, new forms of use of internet and social media, and visualization were transforming the way in which innovation is happening. And these days, you would not design any complex product or service without using those. You'd be too slow and too expensive. Just think about going in a car these days. 20 years ago, the rules about safety for passengers and drivers and so on meant that you had to smash up these mannequins, the car crash test dummies. To build those mannequins in all the different shapes and sizes of us in this room is expensive. To smash a car with them and then test what's happened to them takes a long time. And so the improvement of design of the interior of those cars progresses quite slowly. The big change was when computer simulation became progressed to the point that that data could be delivered by a computer, and you could do 1,000 virtual smashes in a day. And at that point, our cars began to get a lot safer, and the lead time was reduced markedly. And you just would not be a car manufacturer these days if you had to do the old physical smash tests. So there is the point that I'm making about the transformation of the innovation process through the use of digital. So bringing this on to new patterns of innovation, and this is still work in progress. I was fortunate to lead a portfolio of research at Imperial for a 10-year period and looked at issues of open innovation, boundary spanning, how engineers work together and so on. The three crucial technologies that latterly came into view for me, one is the Internet of Things. And this is rather new for some of us, and we're still trying to work out what it means. But this is where you can have sensors, digital sensors, that measure some input and provide you with an output in almost anything, whether it's your toothbrush, whether it's, I'll talk about the device on my arm later, or whether it's the car key that will open the door. And in the last 10 years, we've seen such a proliferation of these little devices that communicate and tell the status that we don't even know how many there are. There are billions and billions of these things in existence, and they're producing data. And the reason why we call them the Internet of Things is they have a little address in there that links them to the internet. And that means that that data can be captured by other people and used to good purpose and sometimes to bad purpose. The second thing is the cloud. And the cloud, what is it? The cloud is a modern word for the internet, and it's a place where some of that data is stored. And the interesting thing is that you don't have to carry it with you to access it. You just have to have a means of connecting in and out of it so that you can use that data. And the cloud is becoming terribly important. And the third that connects to that is the use of mobile devices of all sorts of types. I put mine away so it didn't interfere with the microphone, but I mean, that's proud owner of a rather large iPhone 6 Plus, which does all sorts of fantastic things if you want it to. So these three things, were starting to make a difference. Why were they making a difference, though? This is the question. And the answer is somewhere in the data. And this is my point, that data is becoming the new fuel that is driving innovation. And this is a quantitative shift from, and a qualitative shift from, the previous era of experimentation. Because if you can get your hands on that data, you can construct models and you can start to do things that will allow you to find new products and services for markets. So I worked on a project with colleagues at Imperial and Harvard Business School and IBM, and we produced a paper recently in Harvard Business Review on this, which looked at how data was fueling innovation across many different sectors. And it used those three different areas of technology to understand what was happening. And what we found was that more and more facts of life are becoming digitized. And whether we like it or not, I mean, there's a good set of questions here that we can discuss at the end. And to the extent that organizations were becoming virtual, and that's quite hard to understand sometimes, but for most of history, processes and transactions, in Wedgwood's time, you would have had an invoice and a payslip or something. You'd had some physical replica of what had actually happened, even in the service side. Today, more and more of this is becoming virtual. And we're starting to see that we're moving to a world of anytime, anywhere, anything, which means that we've got availability of information and data, we've got accessibility to it, and we've got an abundance of it. And smart people are picking this up and starting to use it to create new patterns of innovation. And I'm going to give you five illustrations very briefly, because this all sounds a bit abstract, right? So the first one is augmenting products that allow themselves to generate new data. And this is predicated on the use of sensors in existing artifacts. And the best example of that probably is Rolls-Royce with its jet engine. And the brief story is that Rolls-Royce, the number two jet engine manufacturer in the world, 15 years ago, was not making money on producing the product anymore. It was becoming highly competitive to try and do that in terms of price, but very expensive to conduct the R&D, the research and development that was required to create better performing jet engines. And over a period of time, they developed a way of creating a new business, which required data on how the engine performed. And it was only done working with academics in this country by putting sensors in the engine and figuring out how that engine performed. And it allowed them to create an engine health management business, which meant they could lease the engines to the airlines and make their money on the maintenance cycle at the back end of the use of that engine. And that opened a new business model, and it was called Power by the Hour. It's a totally different way of delivering your product. You know you're not going to make money on the product, you're going to make money on its use. And of course, if you're an airline, and most airlines lose money, so they don't want to spend lots of money on engines. Most airlines, if you bought a 747, you'd have four engines on it, you'd buy a fifth one in case there was a problem. You had to drop it off and put another one on there. Of course, if you were leasing the engine, you only leased four of them, so it was cheaper for you as well. So it sounded like one of these perfect business models. You know, that was a win-win for the customer and the supplier. And it's worked. The remarkable thing from an innovation point of view is that all of that data is owned by Rolls-Royce. What can you use that data for? Designing better performing jet engines. You now know things you never knew before about oil viscosity after how many thousand hours of use, about the temperatures on the fan blades. And that is the fuel for the design of the next generation quieter, leaner burn engine. And so that data is what, that's why I said the data is at the heart of this. Pattern two, digitizing assets. This one is very obvious, right? It's completely upended the entertainment industries in the last 10, 15 years. You know, instead of buying a CD, you download the music. instead of buying a newspaper these days, you read it on your device. And it's been a transformation in many areas of media, entertainment, and now increasingly education. You know, we don't know what MOOCs, these massive open online courses, are going to do. But David was telling me about a new MBA where everything is paperless. Okay? So that's a digitization of the asset. And we're seeing it now in areas where it could be incredibly useful for us, because once you've digitized, you can start to analyze collections of that data. So digital health records, highly political in this country for some quite good reasons. If we could ever get over that and manage ourselves in a forward direction, our medics would have access to data that would allow them to do some marvellous work on being more predictive about which one of us in this room might need treating before we got very ill or cost the health service an awful lot of money. But we can't get there without the data. So this is happening in all sorts of unexpected areas. And I mentioned virtualization of enterprise. We've just been funded by KPMG, which is an amazing thing in itself, because KPMG, a partnership, is not known for investing in R&D. £20 million for a new data analytics and visualization center. Why are they interested in that? If you're a third-party auditor of other people's businesses and all the paper trail of invoices just evaporated into the internet and you don't have paper to look at anymore, you better understand what's happening to the virtual business and whether you can actually give a third-party audit on all the supply, finance and so on. There's one funny twist on the back of this digitizing assets, which is 3D printing. Which is taking a digitized asset and making a product out of it, by the way. It's the reverse process. And I just want to hang that there, because that allows you to prototype at the right moment and show someone what it is you've been thinking about doing in a cheap and cheerful way. And it's extremely useful in areas of medicine, particularly if you need to look at what you saw on the image in a three-dimensional way and even practice an operation before you open a patient up. The third area is combining data across industries. And I chair a board for Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, called the Smart London Board. And we've started to work in this area quite significantly. There's a lot of data about how London performs, but it's currently in silos. And it's only used by the people who are managing those different operations. And we've realised that if we can make that data available and make it public, other people will find useful things to do. So we created the London Data Store, and I'd encourage you to look at the London Data Store online. It's probably the number one data store in the world of public data from any city at the moment. Others will catch up and go beyond, I'm sure. And it's been a remarkable thing because it's got data on transport. And there are ways of using that data if you're an app developer, and you can create new services on the back of it, new apps. In 2.5 years, 450 apps have been built by the private sector on transport data and other data that's been produced by London. And I use some of these, and I'm sure you do, and they're useful. And it's other people have figured out the combinations. Many more examples, I won't detain us now with those. Trading data is the fourth one. And actually, we've seen organisations that have got data they didn't know what to do with. They found new purposes and they can make more money out of using them. Vodafone and TomTom. Now, traffic congestion is an annoyance, and sometimes our sat-navs don't work as well as we'd like. But actually, pulling off the GPS trace from Vodafone's data anonymously gives a much more fine-grained view of how congestion's building up and how it might be diffused than the data that comes off the static measurements from TomTom's network. And a deal was struck, it was traded, that they could use that data and remodel how to provide services to you and I as an individual driver. All of it worked off the sort of issues I'm showing you about access to data and where the new businesses will be and how you innovate. And the final example I'll give you is codifying distinct services from things that organisations already do. So larger companies have found that they've had to do things to organise themselves internally, and this is very close to Michael Earle's work, setting up, for example, IBM's global expense reporting solutions came from their own expense management, 420,000 employees around the world having to do expense accounts. They had to do something internally. They shrink wrapped that, and they now sell it as service to hundreds and thousands of other companies. Citigroup, in their digital banking, have done exactly the same in terms of managing transactions. So a lot of ideas are coming out of the use of data in organisations that they've had to develop for themselves, and they're now selling externally. There's some insights of innovation in the digital world. I'm just going to end with some consequences and some views. I've mentioned Internet of Things, cloud and mobile. I think they'll be quite profound. They are already, in terms of transformations we'll experience, particularly in terms of any time, anywhere, anything, as it happens. Is it different now from Wedgwood's day because of the availability of data? I think so. That's my contention. I think we're moving... the innovation process now, the data-rich innovation process, is moving us into a new place. I think it would transform Wedgwood's innovations. You'd have products with RFID chips in them so that they would know what product it was. You'd have services and supply chain processes that would be digitally tagged and organised. You'd have all sorts of other R&D systems with this data in it. I think what we'll come on to in years ahead are new markets that we can only just dream of. Health and well-being, something that we all care deeply about, is the tip of the iceberg on this. And I'm wearing a little measuring device. How many of you have got something that looks like that in the room? I'm sure someone else says, yeah, a few people. So you've joined what we call the quantified self. You know, this is the new world of measuring how your body is starting to perform. It's a toy, it's a game, it's actually quite useful. And within a few years, this will become a serious aid for any of us who need to watch our health in particular ways. And for those who just care about our own well-being, it provides useful information. That data itself is extremely valuable. So the website that my data sits in the cloud has my age, height, sex, weight in there. I hope it's anonymous. I think it is. I don't really care, actually. But when they give me feedback, it shows how much I've moved against other people of the same type and whether I'm more or less. Within a few years, there'll be predictions made on that data with other data about my health and my risks. I don't know what will happen when the insurance companies get hold of that. I do want my doctor to know about it, or I want to know about it, before something major starts to go wrong. And so those are some of the areas I think that the data-rich innovation environment will be working in. See the same thing happening in climate and environment. Areas where you've got huge amounts of data that hitherto have been difficult to process. Look at smart infrastructure. I'm working with Crossrail at the moment about making the most digitally advanced rail system in the world when it opens in 2018. And the amount of information there that we will have to run a safe, reliable, efficient and enjoyable journey for you when you come in out of London. Experimentation matters, and it's going to matter a lot more because how we use this data and how we build our models and how we ask questions is going to make a big difference to where this goes. And that leads me to some thoughts about what talent, what sort of people are we educating to work in this world and participate. I hope I've given enough for you to feel that universities are going to be crucially important. I mean, think of computer science. It didn't exist before the computer as a subject. What about data science? You know, we've only just talked about data science in the last 5 years. Imperial College launched its Data Science Institute this year, and we're just putting on our first data science master's degrees to educate people to start to work using great mathematical skills, also understanding with deep knowledge where the domain expertise is needed in health or environment or in energy. And so those are some of the challenges for us as we go forward. And then think about the machine tools of the data era, the sort of steam engine from Wedgwood's time. What does it look like? Well, there are going to be several. I mean, Google has a lot of this stuff. What about IBM and Watson? The IBM Watson computer that beat the humans at the game Jeopardy. Do you know about this? So Jeopardy is this American game where you're given an answer and you have to figure out what the question was. Any computer scientist in the room will know that it's extremely difficult to program an artificial intelligence machine to tell you the question after you've been given an answer. It's easier to work the other way around. Well, IBM have built a very, very powerful machine that can do that. It's moved on a step already. They've moved to the Watson debater. You know, if Watson was here listening to this, it would ask a very intelligent question of me that I would struggle probably to answer. And it's now moving on to the Watson Discoverer, which is a tool we're very interested in at Imperial because it helps write hypotheses for scientists working in complex data areas in health, for example. And so the machine tools for the data era, for data innovation, are going to really transform how we understand patterns, how we understand behaviours of different populations, because of the patterns that we see in the data. And by the way, Google would not be able to produce the driverless car without access to some of these technologies. The compute that is required to manage that data and for the car to drive itself down the street was 20 years ago just not possible. New York Police Department has a year of experimenting on predicting patterns of crime, and it's reduced crime rate by 12% in the district. It's done that experiment because the computer has managed the data that has been fed into it about patterns from various historic actions that were taken. What does this mean for universities? Well, I think we're in a good place, actually, because our skills are going to be needed. The people we're educating are really going to have all sorts of opportunities. But we also have to think about changing the way that we interrelate. I mean, many of the things, the data is out there, it's not necessarily in the lab. So many of the experiments have to happen in the field. We have to be more market-facing. And the lab is almost everywhere. And that's a change for our academics, for how we work. It means our empirical settings are going to be different. And in some ways, in many ways, we have to be more interdisciplinary because of the way we're trying to get at this stuff. Just think what's going on in synthetic biology or biomedical engineering these days. As for the corporates, I have some big questions in my mind about what the large 20th century corporate is going to do in this space. I mean, you look at some of the data and you wonder what's happening. Large companies' growth in investment in research and development has been slowing. It's more international, that's for sure. China's come on very strongly in the last 10 years. R&D investment's grown by a factor of 15 in the last 10 years from China. But do they have the machine, the system, to really harness data and produce the sort of ideas and solutions that I'm giving you view of? IBM is struggling. You look at its results recently. I wonder where they're going to be and how they're going to mobilise knowledge. Entrepreneurs seem to be riding on a high at the moment in all sorts of ways. The amount of private investment that's putting itself at risk to sponsor new ventures. You know, more than 40 firms have broken $1 billion valuation in the last couple of years. And that's never happened before. The Facebooks, the Groupons, Uber, you know, this taxi app, it raised $1.2 billion in June. It's raising more now. Some people think it could exceed $25 billion. So the sort of spectrum, dimensions of where money is moving to support the new innovation, the new patterns of innovation, is changing. And our pension funds, the institutional investors, are starting to play in that space more. They can't risk not. But then we're seeing valuations that most of us think are pretty crazy for a piece of social networking technology. So it's not evident to me where this is going to end up. One thing I will say is that in many ways, the knowledge has become more dispersed internationally, and we see new players in India and China and elsewhere. But in terms of venture funding, it's still pretty concentrated, you know, in a few places. And it seems to be even more concentrated, if you look at the data, in densely packed urban areas. So parts of Palo Alto have more focused concentration of venture funding than the rest of the Bay Area, than the suburban parts. By and large, the US is by far, in a way, in the lead at putting money at risk for doing this stuff. 2013, $33 billion in venture funding to Europe's $8 billion. And that's something that we have to worry about, because if the corporates are doing incremental stuff, can't organise themselves, think about pharmaceuticals, they've got a broken innovation process. If our universities are nowhere near the scale and capability of doing this, and if it's going to depend upon high-risk venture funding, where are we going to play in this game? By the way, London does pretty well. It's, if you look at it on the World League tables, and it's done better than ever before this year. In the first three quarters, we've gone over $1 billion of money invested in new ventures. But you have to pitch that against $13.5 billion in the Bay Area in the same timescale. So there's an order different in terms of how much money is flowing into these things. The other thing is we're seeing much more disclosures and deal flow coming out of Beijing, Tokyo, Shanghai, Bangalore. So there's some exciting things that we don't understand happening around the world, and we need to keep an eye on that. Perhaps lastly on this, where are the barriers to entry, and where are the things that we can do in this country that might have enduring value, economically and socially? I've already mentioned some of the biomedical areas, and I see some exciting things here in harnessing digital, the data, with the biomedical. And I'll give you one example. A wonderful professor at Imperial, Chris Timizu, won the European Inventor of the Year award this year. He's developed what we would call a lab on a chip. It's a little dongle device called, his business is called DNAE, and it's an electronic device for measuring your DNA. And it can be used by paramedics in the street to take a reading from a sample there and then. And that could be extraordinarily useful. And his business is growing very quickly. But there's a natural barrier to entry. You know, it's not something that the kids on the street making apps can compete with, because you need serious wet lab chemistry, biology, and digital working together. And we've had to provision those spaces for his business because the banks won't lend on a high-risk venture for the facilities. And I think there's an opportunity space in this country, because we're so strong in these areas of science and medicine, for us to create the room for new ventures that can grow and produce really useful technologies, harnessing that data that will help us in our health and well-being. By the way, Chris spun out another company from DNA Electronics called Genot, which is a face cream business where they take a sample and can measure the DNA in your skin and then provide you with a bespoke anti-aging cream. And he opened his shop in Bond Street this year, which will tell you something about how much it costs to do that. I have other questions about what government does. And just as a tease, you know, open data and democratising decision-making in London, one big question. Privacy and security, standards, government's own service delivery, and government support for data-driven innovation, lying somewhere behind that great private sector entrepreneurship machine in the US, is a lot of government support for the Small Business Innovation Research Programme. And just remember that, actually, because the high-risk front end has been taken out through a lot of public subsidy in the US that they don't, and we don't, often give appropriate recognition for. I'll end there. I'm, as David said, responsible for helping to create an ecosystem at Imperial West, our new innovation district in West London. And if you remember, Imperial College's in Exhibition Road, 1851, was the first World Expo. You spent a penny, money went into the tin, and that funded that great district of arts and sciences coming together with the great museums, the Royal Colleges and so on. And it's incumbent on us to create another industrial innovation district with arts and sciences coming together at Imperial West. And I hope we can live up to Wedgwood and others when we do that for the data era. Thank you, David.